From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet one of the top horror film directors, John Carpenter. His movies include Halloween, The Thing, and Escape from New York. Also today, Howard Cruz talks about his cartoon strip, Wendell, about a gay couple and their friends. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording that revives the music of the little-remembered 19th-century composer Al Kahn. And on the bicentennial of the French Revolution, language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg talks about the rhetoric of the revolution. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Associated Press today quoted sources saying a former top official with the Department of Housing and Urban Development will testify against former HUD Secretary Samuel Pierce in exchange for a grant of immunity from prosecution. Deborah Gore Dean reportedly has told congressional investigators she can testify that Pierce personally ordered funding for specific projects under a HUD subsidy program. That program was briefly suspended after HUD auditors criticized the selection process and said a number of prominent Republicans had been able to steer millions of dollars to their clients. Former Attorney General Edwin Meese was cross-examined today in the trial of three of his former associates accused of influence peddling in connection with the WedTech Corporation. Details from NPR's Mike Schuster.
Meese's close friend and personal attorney E. Robert Wallach and two others have been on trial for several months, accused of buying influence during the Reagan administration for the now bankrupt Bronx military contractor WedTech. Meese took the stand for the defense on Monday and was cross-examined today by a federal prosecutor. Meese testified that in the early 80s, Wallach discussed possible contracts for WedTech, and Meese, then advisor to President Reagan, asked that WedTech's bid be given a fair hearing. Meese and Wallach also discussed a possible job for Wallach in the Justice Department, but Meese, as Attorney General, never hired Wallach. Meese himself was investigated by a special prosecutor in 1987 for his role in WedTech, but no charges were ever brought against him. I'm Mike Schuster in New York.
Four former Cuban military officers were executed at dawn in Cuba today for their convictions on drug trafficking charges. Among the men who faced the firing squad was Arnaldo Ochoa, a hero of the communist revolution. Premier Fidel Castro refused to overturn the sentences and asked to begin talks with the U.S. on the drug trade. State Department had a cool reaction to Castro's speech earlier this week, as NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The speech was followed by the execution this morning of General Arnaldo Ochoa and three other former military officers who were convicted of drug trafficking. But the State Department says it is too early to make any judgments about the trial of General Ochoa. Spokesman Richard Boucher says the Bush administration will take a wait-and-see attitude. Boucher says the U.S. wants to see more evidence that Cuba is willing to interdict drug traffickers in Cuban territorial waters and airspace. And he added that talks with Cuba are not planned for now.
You don't automatically start negotiating cooperation until you have an indication the other side is really serious. And that's what we're looking for, is the indication the other side's really serious.
There are reports that the U.S. and Cuba have exchanged informal messages about drug trafficking in the past, and some U.S. officials say the trial and execution of Ochoa might indicate that Castro is sincere about fighting drugs. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 5 points today to close at 25.38. This is NPR News. A pilot who had slumped behind the controls of his plane was rescued from the ocean after his small plane ran out of gas over the Atlantic. Air traffic officials say they heard nothing from Thomas Root after he reported chest pains earlier today. Military pilots and rescuers trained to parachute into ocean waters watched helplessly as their aircraft tracked the single-engine plane for nearly 4 hours while it slowly ran out of gas. The plane crashed in the Atlantic near the Bahamas. Rescuers say they watched in disbelief as Root swam toward them and was pulled alive from the water. He's reported in critical condition in a Miami hospital. After a record 4 terms, Illinois Governor James Thompson says he will not run for re-election. Allison Keyes of member station WBEZ reports.
Thompson says his decision not to run was a difficult one, but one he feels is the best for himself, his family, and for the state. Fighting back tears, the 53-year-old governor called Illinois the quintessential American state and one he loves dearly.
That makes this job the best job in America and awfully hard to leave. But by January of 1991, it will be time for new and different leadership and new and different ideas.
Thompson says Illinois is a better state than it was when he took office in 1977. For National Public Radio, I'm Allison Keyes in Chicago.
The head of NASA said today the new government ethics law has created a very disturbing situation. 9 high-level NASA officials have resigned this year, citing possible financial losses because of the law. The number of firefighters working on blazes in the nation's forest lands fell to about 5,000 today. More than twice that number were on the job as late as Tuesday. Fire crews were winding up work in Arizona, New Mexico, California, Colorado, Utah, and Nebraska. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. 10 years ago, in the Halloween season, moviegoers watched a teenage babysitter, played by newcomer Jamie Lee Curtis, protect herself against a psychotic murderer. He had escaped from a mental institution and returned to his hometown to murder teenage girls, girls who reminded him of his older sister, whom he'd stabbed to death when he was a child. Halloween was a low-budget thriller that was a huge box office success. It established the career of my guest John Carpenter, who directed, co-wrote, and scored the film. Carpenter makes the kinds of movies he's always loved, horror, science fiction, and action films. His movies include The Fog, Escape from New York, the remake of The Thing, Christine, and Starman. In Carpenter's newest movie, They Live, Earth has become a third-world planet exploited by aliens. The aliens disguise themselves as humans and use mass media to hypnotize Earthlings into submission. They Live recently came out on home video. John Carpenter once said he wanted to be the Howard Hawks of the 80s. I asked him what he meant by that.
Well, I probably, when I said that, mean that Howard Hawks was a big influence in my career. I liked the way he made movies, his visual style, his approach to films, his approach to actors, and his point of view on the world. I think that if I had my choice, I'd be doing the kinds of pictures that Hawks did. I wish I could make some Westerns, because they're really my favorite form. Actually, truthfully, that They Live is a Western, but don't tell anybody.
Okay. Let's talk about your first big commercial success, Halloween, which was an independently made film, I believe the most commercially successful independently made film ever made. You shot it in around 20 days for $300,000. You co-wrote, directed, and scored this movie. Did it being a low-budget film help justify you doing all of that? Do you know what I mean?
Well, in a sense, it was my opportunity to do all that. I came from USC film school, in which usually we didn't have any money to do the extra frills that you have in Hollywood, so I was able to do the scores, and I was able to actually shoot some of the films and edit them and so forth, and I brought that kind of approach to filmmaking into commercial filmmaking in Hollywood. And Halloween was the first time that I was able to utilize it with a little bit more money than I'd been used to before. I did my first film for $60,000, and this was a $300,000 film. That was a lot more. And it established me as somebody who could do the scores to films and direct and write and so forth, and I just got lucky.
Halloween was in a way, one of the first in a long string of teenager In Jeopardy movies, where young teenage girls were being threatened and murdered by some demonic, either monster or insane person, preying on them in the suburban neighborhood. How did you come up with this story, and did you intentionally go for a teenager In Jeopardy idea?
Well, in a sense, it was given to me by the producer of the film. He said, let's do a movie about these babysitters who get attacked by this creature. And based on that kind of idea, I came up with Halloween. I think the imitators of Halloween saw a chance to do two things: make lots of money for a low budget, and also perhaps have an entree to get into Hollywood and direct some legitimate pictures. I think people saw it as a vehicle to other avenues. My love of horror and science fiction allowed me to continue in the genre and move out of it occasionally. I did a love story once called Starman, and I did a kung fu picture called Big Trouble in Little China But essentially, I've been associated with the fantasy genre, and Halloween really was the first one.
John Carpenter is my guest, and he directed the films Halloween, The Thing, Christine, Escape from New York, and most of those films he co-wrote as well. In Halloween, there are three teenage girls who are the main characters. One of them is played by Jamie Lee Curtis. Two of the girls are much more socially oriented than the Jamie Lee Curtis character is, and they're already having sex with their boyfriends, where Jamie Lee Curtis is clearly the virgin. Your film was the first in a line of movies where a lot of people thought that the girls who were having sex were being punished by being murdered later on in the movie. Was that a conscious thing on your part? It certainly became a theme as these movies went on.
I think probably what happened was this country started taking an enormous right turn at that point. And I think that people projected that onto the film. Basically, my intention was to show teenagers as realistically as possible. I have nothing against the behavior of the two girls. I will say that from a screenwriter's point of view, the Jamie Lee Curtis character, who was a much more repressed, uncomfortable with her emotions and uncomfortable with being social with her peers, she had a more of a connection with this mad killer and was able to survive him, where the other girls weren't paying attention. They were involved in their own lives and in their interests. So that, from a screenwriter's point of view, was my idea to do what I did.
I think in a lot of ways Halloween was an exercise in building suspense. And let me just play a short clip from the movie. This is a clip of Jamie Lee Curtis. And by the way, this is her first really big film role. And in the credits it says, "Introducing Jamie Lee Curtis." The way the story builds is first she thinks maybe that somebody's following her, and by the end she knows it's true and that she's being attacked. So here she is running from house to house screaming for help. Some of the things that you learned in making Halloween about how to make the audience nervous, how to get them worried about the character's well-being, how to build suspense?
Well, you first have to start with the story. You have to have a story that involves a certain amount of suspense in terms of the characters, the antagonist and the protagonist being on a collision course. Their destinies are going to cross. You know eventually that whatever represents evil in your film is going to have to rear its ugly head and come after you. And your job in a thriller like this is to get the audience to identify with the victim. And Jamie being our focus of identity, we can begin to feel her panic in running away from this kind of ultimate evil that's after her. And I think once you have that kind of a setup, well, you can then begin to build suspense in the audience. Now, suspense really simply means anxiety. The audience is anxious about what's going to be seen, what's going to be coming up. Whenever Jamie would walk into a dark room, perhaps, they'd say, "But don't go in there. Can't you go someplace else?" They're putting themselves into the character. They're trying to tell her to watch out. I think that's the primary idea in Halloween in terms of building suspense.
And the audience knows just a little bit more than the characters do about what's happening. So they know about the danger she's about to get into.
Well, in general, they know that he's out there, because they've known that since the beginning of the film. What they don't know is exactly where he is. So the audience is also waiting in suspense for, when is he going to jump out of the dark? I know it's going to come, because this is a horror film, and they always do this kind of thing, don't they? So now we're walking in a dark room. It's kind of dark in here. Well, now, where will he be? And the longer that you can wait and let the audience imagine where he might be, and then all of a sudden have him spring out, the more in suspense they will be.
You know, Ebert and Siskel, the film reviewers, have something that they call the idiot plot, that a lot of horror movies hinge on the main character doing something absurdly stupid. You know, like, for instance, the character's running, and they just slowly walk away with their back turned, where if they could have ran away really quickly if they were thinking. Do you think that there's a lot of idiot-type plots in suspense films, and is it easy to get around that?
Well, I think that what they're talking about is something that's done intentionally. For instance, in the Friday the 13th movies, the idiot plot was basically invented in order to get the audience to participate. Because if you have a teenager walking into a room, and they turn their back on the danger and wander through kind of innocently, the audience feels superior to the character, and they can start screaming, "You idiot, why don't you get out of there?" And in being superior to the characters, as soon as the incredibly evil and powerful boogeyman steps out, then they can laugh in derision and say, "Oh, I told you so. If you'd only listened to me, you would have it would have saved your life." Basically, this is a technique to get the audience to throw their identity much more towards the killer, which I have a little bit of a problem with. I don't subscribe to that quite so much. I think that we should be making films about the victims and exploring that kind of human emotion. I don't identify with the killers in these films.
Have you seen the movies that came after Halloween that were in part inspired by it? Prom Night, Fright Night, the Friday the 13th movies?
I really didn't have the heart to see them. I've seen occasionally glance at them on television, but they... what bothers me about a lot of horror films is that I don't think they're made by people who have a feeling for the story they're telling. I would say to the audience that there are certain directors who are extremely committed to the genre they're working in, David Cronenberg and George Romero, as two examples. Those filmmakers who feel and have a personal point of view to express in this particular genre. A lot of the movies that copy other films are simply trying to utilize the technique without the heart. And in that sense, I wouldn't recommend them.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your movies, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is film director John Carpenter. His movies include Halloween, the remake of The Thing, Christine, Escape from New York. And he also co-wrote the scripts and composed most of the music for his movies. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
John Carpenter is my guest. And before we completely get off the subject of Halloween, I have to ask you, you know, at the end of Halloween 1, the psychopath dies, we think. Did you intentionally leave this open for a sequel, thinking, well, maybe there's a possibility for another movie here?
Well, when I made Halloween, what I was attempting to do was build a myth, an American myth of evil, because I feel that we are a culture without myths and mysteries. We tend to be technological much more, and we tend to be very sterile in our feelings. And I wanted to create the idea of the ultimate evil, the boogeyman, the legendary mythical creature out there. And of course, he couldn't be killed. And in my mind was not so much a sequel as a kind of an old Henry ending. But I noticed that the audiences over time have become extremely cynical. They assume that if you end a movie uncertainly or with some sort of ambiguity, that the filmmaker is up to a sequel, and that's really a shame. I think this is due in part to television. We have become kind of hypnotized to a certain kind of dramatic form by television. It all has to wrap up for us in the last few minutes, and that's too bad.
Have you been affiliated with any of these sequels? Did you work on any of them?
I produced Halloween 2 and 3, and then I decided that's enough. Mm-hmm. really, sequels, what the studios want you to do in a sequel is to remake the same film again with the same elements, the same characters, and just basically take the script and redo it. And that's difficult to do. Once you've done something, you have to ask yourself, why am I doing this? And we did in Halloween 3, we did a completely different kind of film. Had nothing to do with the shape, had nothing to do with the original characters. And the audience, strangely enough, just wouldn't accept it. They all said, well, where is that killer with a knife? We want to see the same picture again. So at that point, I said, no, I'm not going to do this anymore.
You made, I think, the ultimate New York horror film, Escape from New York, which is this urban fantasy set in the late 1900s in Manhattan, where Manhattan has become a maximum security prison. So the only people there are prisoners, and there's dozens of little prisoner societies there all trying to kill off each other. And Kurt Russell is sent into Manhattan to try to rescue the president, who's been kidnapped by one of these prisoner groups. And it's a very funny movie in a way, in part because, well, let me play a scene which I think explains why. Ernest Borgnine plays a cabbie in this. He's been driving a cab for years, and, you know, he's one of the prisoners on Manhattan Island who's still driving a cab. And although the crime has gotten to the point where there's decapitated heads sitting on top of parking meters, he's talking to Kurt Russell as if it's just the horrors we're regularly familiar with in Manhattan that he's got to face.
Bad neighborhood, Snake. You don't want to be walking from the Bowery to 42nd Street at night. I've been driving a cab here for 30 years, and I'm telling you, you don't walk around here at night. Yes, sir. It'll kill you, strip you in 10 seconds flat. Usually, I'm not down around here myself, but I wanted to catch that show. This stuff is like gold around here, you know. Hey, what were you doing back there, Snake?
Looking for somebody.
Well, why didn't you ask me? Hell, I know everybody in this town. Yes, sir, I've been driving this cab for 30 years, this very same cab.
I'm gonna ask you. Now, where's the president?
The Duke got him. Everybody knows the Duke's got him. Well, you don't have to put a gun to my head, I'll tell you.
Who's the Duke?
The Duke? The Duke of New York, eh, number one? The big man, that's who.
I want to meet this Duke.
You can't meet the Duke. Are you crazy? Nobody gets to meet the Duke. You meet him once and then you're dead.
Although you did create this ultimate New York, ultimate Manhattan paranoid fantasy, you grew up in Kentucky. You grew up in a pretty rural area yourself.
That's right.
Were there movie theaters in walking distance where you grew up?
Not walking distance. I could ride my bicycle down to the theater. I grew up in probably the last time in America where you could really have a small town and really have the kind of innocence and freedom. We didn't lock our doors and so forth. There was no real crime. And I think that my fascination with New York and Los Angeles and big cities, as someone who grew up in the South in a kind of a rural areas, carried me through my filmmaking career. I recall once when I was coming into New York to do some press on a film, and I had read a newspaper account of some plutonium in the water supply in New York. So I asked the driver, I said, well, how do you feel about that? And he kind of grinned with pride. He says, you know, who cares? I thought, that's a really odd attitude. And I noticed that a lot of New Yorkers kind of have a pride about how terrible things are. If there's plutonium or there's a lot of crime on the streets, they kind of, yeah, well, you know, what of it?
We can take it.
We can take it, and we're tough, and I found that to be kind of an unusual attitude, so I kind of incorporated it into Escape from New York.
When you were young and you really liked horror movies a lot and monster movies, did you ever weep seeing a movie, ever cry because you were so scared, or ever ask to leave or, you know, run out in fear?
Well, the first fantasy film I ever saw, my mom took me to see it, came from outer space, and that was in 1953, and it was in 3D, and you put on the glasses, and I had no idea what to expect. And the opening sequence is this meteor streaking across the sky in the desert, and it comes right into the camera and blows up. Well, it came right out of the screen and blew up in my face when I was a kid, and I jumped up and ran up the aisle, and literally in terror. I didn't know what had just happened, but by the time I got to the back of the theater, I thought, boy, that's probably the greatest thing I've ever seen. I've got to go back and see some more of that. So it was a mixture of panic and excitement. And sure, there have been lots of films that the popcorn has gone flying in. And I've never cried in terror. I've cried at sentimental movies. But I think probably the scariest movie I ever saw was The Original Thing. That made me jump a lot.
Oh, my favorite line from that is, the monster's a vegetable. What do you do with a vegetable? Fry it, boil it, cook it. Isn't there a line like that?
There is, and there's also one, an intellectual carrot, the mind boggles.
Your hobbies, I've read, are archery and shooting. And I wonder how they became your hobbies.
Well, I grew up around guns. My parents were hunters and north woodsmen, and I kind of grew up around it, and I took archery in college. And my recent hobby since 1982 is I become a helicopter pilot. And because of my experiences on The Thing, I began to be fascinated with helicopters. Mm. And therefore got my license and bought one, and now I fly the skies of Los Angeles.
Have you ever had to use your bow and arrow or your pistol in self-defense?
Not yet.
Have you ever been victimized?
Well, my parents were robbed once. I remember walking into the house and everything was gone. And it's kind of a strange feeling. When I came out to Los Angeles, I brought a Volkswagen along, and it was stolen, I think, 4 times. And I kept getting it back, and then 6 months later it'd be stolen again. Pretty much it became a kind of a routine, so I expected it to come back eventually. But I've never been physically threatened. But of course, in Los Angeles, when you work in Hollywood, you know, it's all palm trees and swimming pools, so you never have to worry about that.
So is your interest in tough guy stuff purely a movie interest?
Well, not necessarily. I grew up with in the South with a bunch of tough guys, and a bunch of hillbillies from the backwoods, and they'd be glad to teach you a lesson if you cared to learn it. And I think perhaps the my closest friend as a kid was a guy like this, and I patterned my heroes after him.
If you didn't have to worry about commercial concerns, what kind of movie would you most like to do?
I'd probably be doing exactly what I'm doing now. I enjoy making films that have some elements of fantasy in them, whether it's science fiction or horror or whatever. Love to be able to do a musical or do a Western or something like that. But I love the form of Hollywood films, the dramatic form, the three acts, and the basic premise of a Hollywood movie, which is to take you into a dream for an hour and a half and then send you out in the street again. And I suppose that's what I'd be doing.
Well, great. Thank you very much for talking with us.
And thank you.
Director John Carpenter, his latest film, They Live, is out on home video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On the next Fresh Air, my guest will be trumpeter and composer Wynton Marsalis. Here's a little from his new album, Majesty of the Blues.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Wendell is an aspiring novelist, currently out of a job. His lover Ollie runs a photocopying machine while dreaming of a life in the theater. The ups and downs of this gay couple are chronicled in the cartoon strip Wendell. Coming up, we meet Wendell's creator, Howard Cruz. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz introduces us to Al Kahn, an all-but-forgotten 19th-century pianist and composer whose virtuosity rivaled that of Franz Liszt. And while the world is examining how the French Revolution changed politics, our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines how the revolution changed the French language. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. There's a new development in the influence peddling scandal involving the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The Associated Press is reporting that a former top HUD official is seeking immunity from prosecution in exchange for testimony implicating former Secretary Samuel Pierce. An unidentified source told the AP that Deborah Gordine told congressional investigators she can testify that Pierce personally ordered funding for specific projects under the Section 8 Moderate Rehabilitation Program. The program was briefly suspended after the selection process was criticized. A new government ethics law goes into effect on Sunday, and NASA Administrator Richard Truly says that law, along with a pay cap on senior executives, has cost his agency several top managers. At a news conference today, Truly said the loss of employees has created a very disturbing situation.
It's not so much the number, but the quality of and the experience of these people. You know, senior executive service people that leave you take with them 250 to 300 years of government leadership and experience and when they walk out the door.
Truly's comments come one day after the head of NASA's Office of Space Operations quit suddenly, the ninth high-level agency resignation this year. Richard Aller has publicly said that he's leaving because of the ethics law. About 275 union miners were arrested in southern West Virginia this morning after they tried to stop coal trucks from using a bridge. We get details from Beth Voorhees of West Virginia Public Radio.
The miners were taken into custody by West Virginia State Police troopers and charged with obstructing a roadway. The protesters claim loaded coal trucks using the bridge were over the posted weight limit. A state police spokesman says the miners were arrested without incident. The bridge sit-in is just the latest in a string of incidents that have occurred since a union-called cooling-off period began on Monday. Mysterious fires have broken out at mining sites, and company vehicles have had windshields broken by rocks. Meanwhile, the head of the West Virginia State Police put the force on full alert today and has called in all off-duty officers. The state police wants to maintain a high profile in the coal fields as the strike grows more volatile. For National Public Radio, I'm Beth Voorhees in Charleston, West Virginia.
A correspondent for the official labor newspaper in the Soviet Union says Siberian coal miners today ended their four-day strike. The reporter says the miners decided to go back to work after the Soviet coal minister granted them the right to run their own mines. The concessions mark the first time in Soviet history that the government is known to have given in to strikers' demands. President Bush's European tour has taken him to Paris, where he'll attend the 15th annual Summit of Industrialized Nations. Bush arrived in time to witness tomorrow's ceremonies marking the bicentennial of the French Revolution. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up today. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says one of the most quizzical figures in all of music was the 19th century French composer and piano virtuoso who went by the name of Al Kahn. Lloyd has a review of a new recording of Al Kahn music played on the organ.
The composer Al Kahn, whose real name was Charles-Henri Valentin Morange, is probably better known for how he died than for anything he wrote. A recluse most of his life, he was apparently crushed to death when he was reaching up to the top shelf for a volume of the Talmud, the encyclopedic collection of Jewish civil and religious law, and the entire bookcase collapsed on him. Alcan was considered one of the great piano virtuosos of the 19th century, sometimes spoken of in the same breath with Liszt. His music, too, is extremely difficult. There's a piano concerto, for instance, for piano alone. That is, the piano itself also plays the part of the entire orchestra. One of the reasons Alcan is now so little known may be his dedication to playing and writing for an instrument that had only a very brief history, the so-called pedalier, or pedal piano. This is something like a grand piano rigged up like an organ with a pedal board so the bass notes can be played with the feet. Some of Alcan's later music is for either pedal piano or organ. A new album of this forgotten music has been released on the Nimbus label. The performer is the young British organist Kevin Bowyer, and the music is fascinating. Here's part of the seventh of Alcan's 13 prayers. Alcan tended to compose in shorter forms. The longest of the 13 prayers is under 7 minutes. The second selection on this album is the 8 little preludes on the 8 modes of plain chant, and all 8 together last little over 7 minutes. But they are all delightfully inventive, and like all the other pieces on the album, beautifully structured. These little preludes are the only works Alcan published directly for organ. Ironically, they're just for keyboard, no pedals. Here's the delicately haunting third prelude, complete. The longest piece on the Alcan album is the powerful 14-minute impromptu on Luther's A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. And even this piece, probably Alcan's last and greatest work for pedal piano, builds to its magnificent final fugue from a series of brief but intricately woven variations on Martin Luther's famous hymn. All these pieces are vividly played by Kevin Bowyer on the Salisbury Cathedral organ. But what's most impressive about these selections is their astonishing variety of feeling and color. They are celebratory and sinister, grandiloquent and naive. Some seem conservatively rooted in the 19th century. Others sound astonishingly modern with their fascinating textures and harmonies. There are even premonitions of minimalism, though no minimalist I can think of ever wrote anything so short. Nimbus gives us a generous playing time of almost 74 minutes. Unlike a lot of minimalism, when it's over, you want to hear more.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a recording of Al Kann organ music on the Nimbus label. This is Fresh Air. If you took a quick look at the comic strip Wendell, the drawing style might lead you to believe it was in the vein of such mainstream newspaper strips as Dondi or Kathy. But if you looked closer, you'd see it's the story of a gay couple, Wendell and Ollie, and on some pages, you'd notice they didn't have any clothes on. Wendell is published twice a month in the national gay news magazine The Advocate. A collection of strips called Wendell on the Rebound has just been published by St. Martin's Press. Wendell's creator, Howard Cruz, started his career in the 70s drawing for underground comics. He started drawing Wendell in 1983. Cruz satirizes many aspects of gay life, but some people just can't take a joke. In 1987, an anonymous letter came to The Advocate that said, "Howard Cruz depicts all gay men as repulsive, pathetic, vapid queens. I am an attorney, and my lover is a professional football player. We take pride in our manliness, our physiques."
I think that may be one of the most famous letters to the editor in the annals of gay publications, because it drew a tremendous response at The Advocate in defense of Wendell. I think everyone who publishes things has the fear that a critic or a letter to the editor sometime or other will nail them on things that they secretly know they're vulnerable on. And so when I got a really hostile letter, and that was it, I felt a great sense of relief, because I think that Wendell is demonstrably not guilty on those counts. I think Wendell specifically undermines stereotypes from the word go. I think one of the things I try to do in my gay-related work repeatedly is to perhaps take the reader a bit close to a stereotype and then demonstrate that the person behind there is actually a full-blooded person and not to be summed up in one phrase.
Can you give us an example?
Well, there is an elderly, maybe too strong a word, but they're getting on in years, gay couple, Wendell's uncle, Uncle Luke, and his lover, Clark. But they are superficially the stereotype of the old gay queens. They are funny, loud, and irreverent. However, contrary to the stereotype, they're both politically involved. Their humor does not come from despair. They are a fulfilled couple, and they are simply having fun in life. And this squares with my experience of many of the actual gay people who superficially people might dismiss as, quote, screaming queens, unquote.
You've parodied the kind of people who think that there should just be one kind of gay model. And in one of your non-Wendell comics, you invented a group called the Respectability Cadre of the Gays for Righteous Image Management. And, of course, the acronym for that is GRIM.
Exactly. Well, this attitude persists. There's a new book, which I only know by reputation, and perhaps it's unfair to mention it. It's called After the Ball, by some gay men who, from the quotes in the reviews, apparently find drag queens embarrassing to the gay movement. This attitude I object to, because I think the wonderful aspect of the gay movement is the incredible diversity, the fact that people really can be themselves in such a wide spectrum of ways.
Wendell and his lover, Ollie, have a child in their life. It's mm-hmm. Ollie's son from
his former marriage.
And one day during a gay pride march, it's gay pride day, mm-hmm. The son is coming along, and the Ollie puts on him an I'm Proud of My Gay Daddy t-shirt, and the son objects. Can you read some of this comic for us?
Well, this basically, Farley is the name of the son, and he's getting a little older than he was when the strip started, and he has always been sort of comfortably in the corner of Wendell and Ollie and the gay movement. And basically, he's resisting being assumed to be on hand to be their spokesman at all times. And he objects. They're all set for the parade, and he's got the shirt on, I'm proud of my gay daddy. But apparently he's giving problems. And Ollie says, okay, twerp, you've been a pill all morning. You want to get something out of your system? And he says, I hate this t-shirt. And Ollie says, don't you want to go to the gay parade with us this year, son? He says, sure, I just don't want to wear this stupid shirt. Farley, says Ollie, this is really coming at us out of left field, you know. If we'd known you were going to hate this shirt, we wouldn't have had it made for you. Wendell says, would you like to carry a sign like you did last year? No, I don't want to carry a sign, says Farley. You are still proud of your daddy, aren't you? Says Ollie. Farley says, I don't see you waving any signs about being proud of me. Farley, says Ollie, your mother and Wendell and I are all real proud of you. Show me the t-shirt that says so. Farley, be reasonable, Wendell says. And Ollie says, I'll level with you, son. Your mom has never been too thrilled about us bringing you to gay pride marches. But she's agreed to it, though, because you've always said you wanted to come. But she thinks it's important for people to understand why you're here. Maybe I'm a kid faggot. How would you like that? Says Farley, at which Ollie starts trembling. Wendell, he's tapping into my parenting anxieties. So he's just doing a little bit of rebelling there.
Have you noticed this with children who you know who are expected to wear the t-shirts and everything?
Well, exactly. I think children will, for a while, they will be herded along, as I was, in the service of their parents' ideologies. My father was a preacher, so I was a good minister's son for a while. But then the time came when I had to establish my own identity.
You mentioned that your father was a minister. He was a Baptist minister mm-hmm. in Alabama. What was his attitude about homosexuality?
Well, he got a few, the sort of earliest hints that this was going to be an issue in my life. By the way, he's dead. He's been dead since I was in college. And I was just in the process of coming to terms, well, I shouldn't say that. I was in the process of realizing that I was gay. It was a few years after that, I'd say, that I came to understand it and feel good about it. But he saw, you know, I confided a few inklings of that, and he thought it was just that I was embarrassed because I was masturbating too much or something. I don't know. I think he had a somewhat simplistic notion of what gayness was about.
Your comic, Wendell, has been published in the Gay Press and the Advocate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, especially during the hiatus when you were out of the Advocate, if you ever tried to get Wendell into a newspaper or mainstream magazine or something. And I guess what I'm asking is not only if you'd be interested in that, but also if you think the mainstream press would be ready yet for something like that.
Well, I know that newspapers wouldn't. I mean, this is not even worth wasting any time on. I think it's a shame. I think that there would be nothing that would be better for, well, there may be a few things that would be better for the country, but a thing that would be good for the country would be to have next to Dick Tracy and the Funny Papers to have an ongoing story about gay characters. However, I know that the problem there is to a certain extent editors and even more so advertisers and editors' fear of advertisers. And considering how Doonesbury always has a lot of editors ready to drop him at the mention of the word gay, I know that an all-gay or predominantly gay strip is not going to make it in newspapers. Sometimes I've thought about Wendell in some other context. I like the fact that by being in a gay magazine, I don't have to educate the audience about some of the simple basics about, you know, what gay life is all about. On the other hand, I do hope that a book collection of Wendell will be looked at by people who aren't gay, because I think they perhaps can benefit by this window into a new world.
Well, in order to draw Wendell, in order to edit the gay comics that you did before Wendell, you had to come out professionally.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any fears about doing that?
Well, I was terrified because I really wanted to be a professional cartoonist, and I had spent a number of years being a professional cartoonist before I came out. And part of this was a structured plan. I had decided back in the early 70s that I wanted to be openly gay in my work. And I had spent most of the 70s trying to establish a career that would withstand this coming out process. And, so far it has, and so far I still have a foot in the mainstream world at the same time that I'm very well known, and perhaps to some degree stereotyped myself as a gay cartoonist. But I think people who pay any attention to my career have to realize that I've dealt with a lot of topics beyond gay topics and appeared in a lot of places, even the quintessentially heterosexual Playboy magazine.
You've been living with Ollie and Wendell in your mind for a long time now. Do you really want to keep them going for a long time?
I like these characters. I find them interesting, and I find their lives interesting. I don't know. I probably would not spend my life specifically in the harness that I'm in now, doing a comic strip every 2 weeks for The Advocate. I admire the attitude that the people who did the Mary Tyler Moore Show when they said, let's do a good show for a while and then stop.
Mm-hmm.
And not try to do it forever. And so I would not want to do this forever. But I would definitely, like to find ways to bring the characters back periodically, even if I was not doing the strip on an every week basis.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Cartoonist Howard Cruz, his new book, Wendell on the Rebound, has just been published by St. Martin's Press. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, you've been following the president around Europe all week. Today he's in Paris.
In Paris for the summit, Terry, and we're still following him. But in addition to the issues that the president will be talking about at the summit meeting, we're also going to take a look at the French and their revolution. They're celebrating the bicentennial of that event, and apparently not all the French agree that they should be celebrating it. We're also going to look at the issues between the Pittston Coal Group and the United Mine Workers in that strike. And we have a variety of other things, ranging from cold fusion, which the government says failed, to toadfish.
Thanks, Linda. That and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The French are celebrating the bicentennial of their revolution. At language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg's house, they're thinking about the language of the revolution.
Every once in a while, something happens to remind me again just how French my wife is. Not long ago, we rented Danton, André Vida's movie about France at the height of the Reign of Terror, when the revolution was devouring its children. We were eyeball deep in carnage when I said, you know, Mirabeau was probably right, the French should have gone with a constitutional monarchy. At which point she turned on me and snapped, Mirabeau was a royalist insect. It goes to show that the very French are different from you and me, particularly when the talk turns to politics. It's hard to imagine a contemporary American getting that worked up over George III. But then, the American Revolution was basically an administrative readjustment, whereas the French Revolution was a violent overthrow of the social order. In the words of a contemporary song, it was the world turned upside down. It was also the word turned upside down, as the historian Francois Furet has observed. As he put it, It was a time when all power resided in the word. In particular, the revolutionaries tried to remake the French language into a fit instrument for the new order. They abolished all titles and called one another citizen, the way the Soviets would use comrade 125 years later. They eliminated the formal pronoun vous in favor of the egalitarian tu. As in America, the revolutionaries changed the names of places associated with the old order. The square of Louis XV in Paris became the square of the revolution. That's where they set up Dr. Guillotin's new machine, as it was called, which soon earned the nicknames of the shortener and the national razor. The mania for revolutionary renaming affected the names of clothes and food. Fashionable hostesses served chicken a la Bastille and quail in national convention sauce. Even the names of playing cards were purified. The king became a revolutionary general. The queen became Lady Liberty. Time itself was relabeled and restarted. France abandoned the Gregorian calendar, which was associated with the church. The year one of the revolutionary calendar began on the date of the adoption of the Constitution in 1792. It was all part of an attempt to create what one revolutionary called an empire of images, as if the revolution could sweep away the old orders of Christianity and feudalism in a vast linguistic purge. Most of the new words didn't outlive the revolutionary period, nor, for that matter, did most of the revolutionaries who coined them. Napoleon abandoned the revolutionary calendar in 1806 when he signed a concord with the Pope. While he was at it, he rebaptized the Square of the Revolution as the Square of the Concord, or the Place de la Concorde, which it remains to this day. And yet, the memory of the great renaming had an enduring effect on French political consciousness. Once you've cut the bond between names and things, you've lost linguistic innocence. From that moment, the social order lives under a blade that could drop again at any instant. François Furet has claimed that the linguistic experience of the revolution was the source of the characteristic French penchant for seeing politics as a kind of theater, and the reason that the French aligned themselves at the political extremes. Lately, however, the French have been in an uproar over Furet's new book, Republic of the Center. He notes that the communists are in a shambles and that the extreme right has lost ground, and he claims that French politics have come to rest permanently in the center. According to Furet, France is now a stable, practical republic, like its allies, and the language of French politics has lost its theatrical dimension. In his most controversial phrase, he says that now, finally, after 200 years, the French Revolution is over. Well, maybe at his house.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Many of the commentaries and interviews on Fresh Air are edited and mixed by Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Trumpeter Wynton Marsalis has won Grammys for his recordings of both jazz and classical music. We'll meet him on the next Fresh Air. Also, we talk with singer and songwriter Lucinda Williams, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the latest James Bond film, License to Kill. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.